You're listening to a Day1.fm show.
Welcome to the first ever episode of Diaspora.nz, where we're seeking out and profiling the hidden gems, founders, innovators, and up-and-coming leaders of the great Kiwi expat community as they hustle their way to success around the world. I'm your host, David Booth, and today we're chatting with Thomas Harding, who, coming on 4 years ago now, founded a company called MishGuru, providing content management and analytics tools to brands who advertise on Snapchat. They've gone from strength to strength, raised over $2 million from top investors, including Global from day one, and signed up brands like Spotify, Visa, McDonald's, and PlayStation. Today, we're digging into how the content marketing space is evolving, with Goliath tech companies battling it out for millennial attention.
Yeah, well, I mean, you just got to look at the consumption behaviors of you know, the next generation of people coming through, right?
Tom's also based in New York, but with his co-founders in Berlin and Auckland, and quickly grown team of 22 spread across 5 locations, we chat about how they hire, manage, and inspire this distributed workforce.
One of the things for all the roles that we bring on is actually a requirement that they spend a portion of those first 90 days working remotely.
But that's enough out of me. Let's get over and chat with Tom.
So we're sitting here today with Tom Harding, CEO of MishGuru. Tom, thanks so much for joining us. Love to learn a little bit about the early days. How did Tom Harding get started? How did you make it into startup land, found MishGuru, and come to be living in New York?
Cool, easy question straight up there. So yeah, really for me, got my first taste of what startups are about back in university. Down at Canterbury there, I just finished my Bachelor of Engineering and then jumped into the Master's Program of Engineering Management. And they have a program there called Entree, which is an opportunity for students to test the waters in the land of startups and see, you know, what that process looks like. A classmate and myself ran through the program, had an idea, really enjoyed the challenge of it, realized at the end of it our idea, you know, wasn't super viable. And so from there, I was lucky enough to move along to a software consultancy company down in Christchurch, a firm called Memia, where I continued to get that exposure to what it was like to work with software companies and what it was like to work with early stage businesses and see some of those challenges firsthand. And then from there, jumped into Lightning Lab, came in with one idea, came out with a very radically different idea, which is MishGuru that we're working on today. And so, you know, been working here at MishGuru for 3 years now, which I'm sure we'll talk more about today.
So tell me about this first company. This isn't your first rodeo, which is awesome to sort of have a second go at it. And I was trying to remember, actually, we were introduced originally by a guy called Sam Ragnarsson, I think. And so massive shout out to Sam for the introduction here. And you were building Site Sorted and you were really bullish on it. You thought this was the next big thing. What did you learn through that made you realize that maybe it wasn't and made you want to move on to the next thing?
Yeah, so Site Sorted, that was a company we were working on while I was at Memia. Really simple and I thought a great concept, helping construction sites get better at health and safety reporting. You know, I personally still think there's a really great opportunity in that space. One of the things we learned, and I think I really took away from that, was the concept of, you know, hustle. So getting out, talking to people, getting your concept in front of people, getting things moving, you know, when you've got really, really limited resources. So at the time, it was just me and a couple other guys. We didn't really have any dev resource. So, you know, we were gluing things together and making things work, and actually managed to get some really amazing results out the back end of it, validated the idea. People in the space loved it. But, you know, in that particular instance, I think the reality was, for me, health and safety wasn't in a space I was passionate about and wasn't something I could see myself, you know, committing the next few years of my life to. And so, I always knew it was kind of limited. And so, once I saw the opportunity to move on, I sort of handed that off to a few other guys.
To dig into that a little bit, I mean, not the thing that you were wanting to dedicate your life to, but then you went into the Lightning Lab with an idea about 3D printing horseshoes. And was 3D printing horseshoes the thing that you wanted to dedicate your life to? Or was that sort of another step along the way? And actually, just to build on that, I mean, what I'm really interested in is what was going through your mind at the time when you, 2 weeks out from demo day, if I remember rightly, decided to get up on stage and still explain, you know, what you were doing next?
Yeah, so Lightning Lab for me was a really interesting piece of timing. I'd just come back from a little bit of overseas travel, had a friend who had a team drop out at the very last minute going into Lightning Lab. had asked me whether I was interested in participating. And you know, I'd been keeping an eye on Lightning Lab. I saw what had happened the year before. I thought the program looked really great. I thought the pool of mentors and advisors involved in the program looked really great. And I saw it, you know, as an opportunity to continue that learning as opposed to something, you know, I necessarily was hungry and passionate to work on. That being said, I thought the idea had really, really great promise. I guess as a part of that program, we learned that maybe wasn't so suited for that style of format of growing a company, but still lots of really great learnings to take out of that one as well, which definitely helped me as we progress through the journey onto Mesh.
Brilliant. So let's bring it back to the present day a little bit. The thing that I really want to be able to do with this is dig into what you are the most passionate about now and what you're the most knowledgeable about now. And one thing which is immediately obvious is MishGuru is a platform for Snapchat marketing and analytics. So you are clearly watching Snap and Snap Inc.'s movements quite closely. Now, they've just gone public. The whole world has an opinion. People are saying that the growth is stalling, that Facebook's copying everything. You guys are, I suppose, quite aligned with their success. So just want to understand how you're thinking about this risk and what the prospects are for Snap in the future.
Yeah, cool. No, certainly something we think a lot about, given that, you know, we're built entirely on their platform. And, you know, there's a lot of noise right now, and really we expect there to continue to be a lot of noise over the next few months. Everyone's seen what's happened with Twitter in the terms of what happened with the follower growth and all those kinds of things. But I think the reality for Snap, and they've come out and publicly said this, is they know that if they can continue to hold the attention of the demographic that they currently have, that they will be okay. And so I think for them right now, you know, they're playing a pretty smart game in that they're not sitting here selling this giant user growth story. They're saying, hey, we've got a great audience. We've got a really highly valuable audience. Yes, we're looking to continue to grow. Obviously, we would love if more and more people in the world did that, but they're not letting that distract them from continuing to build a great product. So certainly something we're keeping a close eye on is you know, how they're performing. But on the flip side of that, I mean, I guess to kind of expand a bit on what we're about at Mish is, you know, what we say is we help brands tell really good stories. And one thing that's happened and is crazy to watch this in front of us right now is just, you know, looking at that format of stories that Snapchat, while they pioneered it, certainly isn't unique to them anymore. And so we've seen a whole heap of platforms commandeer it. Facebook's pretty guilty of this one, so you were seeing it now on Facebook itself, Messenger, Instagram, WhatsApp. A whole heap of these platforms are also using stories as a format. And so for us looking at this, you know, we think we can de-risk a bit by becoming platform agnostic and saying, well, you know, we will go with the users and the platform make sense and where the engagement is. And so,
interesting. So, you know, so when you
not,
think about
not ruling out moving across.
So when you but when you think about a growth strategy, you are potentially platform agnostic, because I mean, I sort of hear noises about Musical.ly being a next comer, or about you know, what's the next generation that's currently in their tweens or pre-tweens going to be using in their early to mid-teens. Do you have like a platform in mind in particular, or are you more referring to sort of Instagram and the current the giants?
Yeah. Well, my product team will hate me for talking about that. But yeah, look, I think
don't go anywhere. They wouldn't want you to.
No, the hot space for us right now is pretty obviously Instagram. It's coming through really strongly from our clients, and that, you know, they're doing storytelling on Snapchat, and so if they're already doing it here, then should they also be doing it over there? And can hurry up, build some tools to help them with that. So something we're keeping a close eye on at the moment. But I guess the challenge for us being a fairly small team is, you know, where do you dedicate the resources and how do you, you know, make the most of what you've got? And, you know, at which point do you feel comfortable that you've conquered one platform to the point where, hey, we can actually start moving that resource over to a new one? And you know, to be honest, I don't think we're there just yet. I think there's lots more room for growth in the world of Snapchat. And so, you know, we're doubling down on that for now, but certainly keeping our eyes open.
Brilliant. Part of this, I suppose, really came through for me in a blog that you'd linked to in your Mish Monthly, which is a outstanding newsletter, by the way. The article was titled, "Stop with the Social, Why Snap is Actually a Broadcast Network." the interesting thing I thought about that was it sort of plays into a trend that, you know, it is probably the best bull case for Snapchat. And when I say Snapchat, I really mean not just Snapchat, but also the way that Instagram is using stories. A lot of the attention that used to be on TV and TV advertising is now shifting to Snapchat and Snapchat advertising. Do you agree with that? How do you sort of think about that trend?
Yeah, well, I mean, you just got to look at the consumption behaviors of you know, the next generation of people coming through, right? It was a funny conversation I was having with my girlfriend a couple of weeks back about the concept of a TV show, and we're still calling these things TV shows, yet we don't even own a TV, right?
Right.
All of us are consuming this content on mobile phones, on laptops, and so, you know, I think the idea that Snapchat is eating into this broadcast space, you know, it seems kind of obvious. They're following the users and where the users are consuming content, and they've just built a really nice platform for users to do that. So, you know, I think a lot of TV execs out there are probably looking pretty closely at this space. You know, we've already seen NBC Universal put in quite a substantial amount of money in Snapchat's IPO. A whole bunch of deals are coming through right now. We're seeing the AFL, the NFL are looking at moving some of their content over there as well, because they know this is a platform where the audience attention is being held. And if that's the case, I think, you know, the monetization through what was previously a TV ad is now being replicated in this digital format.
Right. So the attention, sort of the age group or the class is Snapchat, maybe it's on Netflix, but ultimately moving towards an on-demand. When you think about your business, and I know there is an element of content creation in there as well, do you sort of want to continue moving in that direction, or with all of these big, you know, traditional content generators coming in, how does that factor into the strategy?
Yeah, I mean, to step back a little bit to explain the content creation side of things, you know, we started Mish 3 years ago, and so when we were pitching the idea of a software tool to help brands manage Snapchat accounts, you know, a lot of the early feedback we got was, hey, really cool idea for a tool, but actually we don't know anything about creating content for this new platform, for this, you know, we're talking about suddenly vertical video on a mobile phone versus, you know, a Facebook post, which even then was quite different. And so what you're describing for us creating content for clients was actually a reaction to a gap in order to fill before we could sell our software product. And so for us now looking at the space, it's kind of clear that, you know, the market has educated itself and is capable of skipping that step of needing to be handheld through the content creation. Well, for the most part, there's still some specific cases where, you know, people don't yet get it, and so we're willing to help out. But for us, we're a technology company. We set out to be a technology company from day one, and so for us the growth is in that, you know, product and technology space rather than that more agency-style offering of creating content, of coming up with you know, the concepts and account management and all that kind of thing.
Brilliant. And so that just means there's going to be more people making that content, and, you know, if anything they need a way to manage it and to do the analytics. So that's really exciting. Let's step out a little bit into the business itself. And one thing that I find interesting is your three co-founders, based, obviously you're in New York a lot of the time. You've got one over in Berlin, you've got one back in New Zealand, you've got a team in San Francisco, still quite a small team, but you're spread around the four corners of the world. Is there anything that you've done to build a team culture while you're so distributed, and how do you sort of run the company?
Yeah. This is something we think a lot about. So one of the things that you kind of read online a lot when you're trying to research remote teams is this concept of remote friendly versus remote first companies. And it's quite a subtle but very important distinction between the way that you set a company up. So, you know, for us, we actually started out from day one being a remote company. And what that does is, it means you build all of the processes for how you communicate between each other around not actually being in the same room as each other. So a really good example is, say, you know, we have our weekly team meeting, and that's done in a way where the expectation is that you are not in the room with each other, and therefore you have to be ready to communicate, you know, remotely, versus, I think, you know, some of these teams now who build as a local team and then look to move to a remote team, and suddenly you've got one person Skyping into a team meeting, and there's this weird feeling where, you know, I'm not sure if you've experienced it, but if you're the person on the Skype, you can't necessarily hear everything that's going on. There's conversations happening to the side. And it just doesn't feel like you're fully a part of the picture and not fully a part of the team. And so for us, you know, everything we've built has been around the giving people the freedom to, you know, be in a different location. And so setting that foundation has been super useful and, you know, creating the right environment where, you know, whether you're in the office or not, you can still succeed in your role. Other than that, you know, I think it just comes down to communication and really, I think, over-communicating. So there's times where it maybe doesn't feel so natural to communicate things that seem kind of simple and straightforward, but I think pushing that information out as often and frequently as you can just really helps with that culture.
And has there been anything that's been a particularly useful sort of resource when thinking about how to build this? Or have you, I mean, are you literally making stuff up as you go? Or do you look to companies like Buffer as a prominent example of a distributed company? You know, WordPress, there's a few others. Where are you getting this stuff from?
Yeah, no, there's certainly a few. So Buffer, Zapper, yeah, WordPress, like you mentioned. So, you know, I think there's some guys pioneering right now, and it's awesome, you know, especially looking at a company like Buffer who are willing to share this kind of information. And I've actually emailed some of the people on there when we've had, you know, these hard problems. Okay. But, you know, the reality is it's not that common, and there's always going to be these small edge cases. And I think just coming at it with an open mind and being prepared to adapt and change is really key. And, you know, for us, we're actually going through this constantly. Like, we've gone from a team of, I think it was 7 or 8 in November last year, and now we're a team of 17. And so things that worked then definitely aren't working right now. And so just, I think, setting the context amongst everyone that, you know, things will break and it's okay that things break, but just put your hand up if you see that happening and be, you know, willing to come up with ideas on how maybe we can fix some of these things. Helps us a lot.
So like a natural next question, I suppose, is when you're thinking about looking at stuff that might be breaking and how can you fix it, what are the key metrics that you're using to track the business? I mean, you can go as deep a detail as you like, but is there an impressions per campaign or obviously each customer has a lifetime value and a cost of acquiring them, and really keen to understand sort of some of the key growth drivers that you are watching as a business?
Yeah, on the growth side, you know, we keep it pretty simple. So the metric we track there is the monthly recurring revenue. I think, you know, cash...
Pretty crucial one, that one, yeah.
Cash through the door is a pretty straightforward way to tell whether things are working or not. So on the growth side, yep, certainly looking at that. We do keep a close eye on cost of acquisition. You know, we want to be able to experiment with these things and try new and different ways of approaching it, but there has to be some natural constraint. You know, you can't sort of just throw everything at winning, you know, a small set of clients if the numbers don't add up. So there's that on that side. I mean, just to quickly the team side, we use this amazing tool. It's called Office Vibe. It plugs into Slack. If anyone is in a remote team, really recommend plugging that in. And what it does is just pings each of the members on your team, you know, once a week, gives you an anonymous survey, and at the end of that, it gives you metrics on the health of your team across a number of sort of specifics. So, you know, what is the wellness of the team like? What's the morale of the team like? All the different things which, you know, really help you keep your finger on the pulse and understand, you know, are people happy? Cool. And then for us, it's about, you know, is the growth of the company coming along? Yep, cool, let's double down.
No, definitely a lot to continue to develop there, and if you can find any tools, I reckon the best thing you can do is sort of follow the example of what Buffer's done and just blog about it, tell people about it, and a lot of you know, the next generation of founders will come along and say, hey, that's a pretty good idea. With the remote team, just so much more important as well. When you're in New York, though, I mean, New York's one of the places where the Kiwi expat network is the strongest, I suppose. There's a lot of people there. Do you find yourself spending a lot of time with them, or are you more making a point of getting out and meeting New Yorkers? How's life in New York? Let's do that question.
I think it'd be silly to not take advantage of the really great network that's here. So I actually have a couple of my key advisors who we actually picked up very early on in our journey, who, you know, I catch up with every month. We have you know, breakfasts and we go out for beers and all those kinds of things, because, you know, it is good to meet people who have, you know, experienced the same challenges as you, and maybe you're one or two steps ahead, and, you know, you come across a problem and you can either, you know, try work it out from scratch, or spend 30 minutes, ask someone and come out the door with, you know, the exact right answer. I think there is some challenges for Kiwis who come over here, and making sure they do expand the circles and you know, cast the net a bit wider. I think there's some really great tools available to people now. So, you know, I would just say, if you're coming to the city, get on Meetup straight away, see what's, you know, relevant to your space, and just get along to as many events, meet as many people as you can. I know I spent basically my first 12 months just trying to build that network, and to the point where now, you know, if there's someone I want to reach, there's a much, much greater chance that, you know, sit within my network of people I've met over the last 18 months, as opposed to if I had have just, you know, stuck in those Kiwi circles.
That's brilliant. And those key early advisors have sort of been there along the way, and obviously still really valuable. Have you intentionally gone out to pick up newer advisors in particular areas, or does this sort of just happen naturally?
Yeah, so this is something we're working through at the moment, actually, is you know, spending the time to understand the gaps that you have on the current team, and then saying, okay, we want to fill those gaps. To be honest, I don't have a perfect answer for you here just yet. We've kind of taken things as they've come, which has worked well to get us to this point. But I think for us, it's quite clear there are some specifics, and we will need to find, you know, people to fill those gaps rather than, you know, continuing that same way we previously have.
Right. And that, I mean, that applies for across the board. Obviously, the advisors, it's really important, but recruiting and building the team, it's really important as well. And you're in this quite unique position that I'm sure you've probably done it already. And if you haven't, you will in the future. You'll be hiring people that you've never met in person, and the only calls are over Skype, and the only time, you know, they might work with you for 6 months before you meet them. Is there anything that you're sort of consciously doing within your recruiting process to make sure that they're going to be comfortable performing in the same remote environment? What's the recruiting secret sauce?
Yeah, cool. So one of the things we realized a couple of months back, when we were a team of eight, is that what we had as a team was pretty awesome. Like, everyone who worked on the team loved it. Like, we have an amazing set of metrics around retaining our key team. And so one of the things we said as a team was, in recognition of the growth that was about to happen, was we want to make sure we continue to replicate what we currently have. And so, you know, the natural step there was to go through that process of actually, you know, trying to understand what are the elements of our culture that we all hold, you know, hold close and really value. And so the outcome of that was a set of values, which, you know, we then said, hey, this is actually what we think is the best shot at creating a roadmap for hiring. And so, you know, as we're now going through this hiring process, you know, there's obviously a number of technical questions and all that kind of stuff that you want to get out of the way. But we actually have an entirely dedicated, one of the interviews is just around culture. And the whole point is trying to get out, you know, what do these people relate well to the five values that we've, you know, documented and said, you know, this is what we're about. A slight extension of that, once we have got people on board and we felt comfortable that they do meet those criteria, is we actually have created, you know, a really solid plan for each new employee around what their first 90 days should look like, so their 90-day KPIs. And one of the things for all the roles that we bring on is actually a requirement that they spend a portion of those first 90 days working remotely. So whether that be, you know, just another co-working space across the city, or perhaps they want to travel across the other side of the country and you know, work with their family on the other side for a few days or a week or whatever it is, we you know, we really heavily encourage that, or push that as a part of that 90 days just to test and see whether it's worked out or not. And, you know, at the end of the 90 days, we can have a conversation. If they don't feel comfortable with that as a work style, then, you know, it's maybe isn't a good fit for us in both directions.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You recently retweeted, hey, or tweeted out a link to a piece that Phil McCaw at Movac wrote, and he was talking about NZ innovation, and you're sort of agreeing with a comment that was made in the article that we're not quite there yet when it comes to accelerators and development orientated funding specifically. I'd love if, I mean, as a man who's been through the process, you've raised some money in New Zealand, you've just raised some money in the US. What are your thoughts on what was wrong with that first step, and maybe what could be done a bit better?
Yeah, look, I think on the accelerator side, you know, we all know that New Zealand is a small country, right? There's 4 million people, and at the moment there seems like an equivalent number of accelerators happening. And you know, they're going niche and focusing on one thing, but, you know, personally, I don't believe that we have the depth of advisors, we don't have the depth of investors and all those supporting aspects to actually make these programs a success. And so, you know, I thought Lightning Lab was a beautiful concept, it was really well executed. We had one a year, one demo day a year, everyone got around this thing and you know, supported it. And now suddenly we've got three or four of these things and you know, they all kind of feel a bit watered down. And, you know, I've heard from a few investors, it's just like, we don't have enough good companies to put through these programs. And so instead of there being one or two good companies in each program, we're just, you know, we're seeing some of these programs not really deliver on maybe what they promise, which, you know, is a bit of a shame, but I think that's probably going to self-correct. You know, there's only so much money to go around, and I'm sure pretty shortly we'll see something happen there.
But I'd make the case, I suppose, that regardless of what happened back there, I mean, you've told me in the past that so much of the actual, you know, Mish story really fell together once you got out of the country and once you hit the ground in the US. And is that the key takeaway here, that just the founder who's back home just needs to get their ass on a plane and spend some time in their market in San Francisco, New York, London, wherever, you know, Southeast Asia, wherever they're aiming?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a tough one, and I've gone backwards and forwards on this a little bit. I think the reality is, you know, each founder has to assess their own situation and understand, for my business, do I have to be next to my customers? And in our case, the answer was yes. Yes, we did need to be on the ground talking to people, building those relationships, because that was how we sell our product. So we have a sales team who talk to people and sell the product. You know, I think if you're building one of these more automated, you know, web tools where people can self-sign up and all those things, you know, I would say take a good look before you jump on a plane, because it's not cheap to come over here, not in San Francisco, LA, or New York. And so if you're going to do it, you want to be really sure that that's the place, you know, you should be. And I guess just to expand a bit on the context of how I approached it was, you know, I didn't just book like a one-way ticket or anything like that. I actually booked a ticket for 3 months, did a month in LA, did a month in San Francisco, and a month in New York. And my goal was to understand which of those places, if any, made sense for our business, and you know, had a number of tests around, you know, how many meetings could I generate during those periods and some other, you know, tests like that. And the result was, yes, actually, we should be here. And, you know, after that, the decision was made to set up more permanently.
No, that makes a lot of sense. Hey, What we'll do is sort of move it into a bit of a wrap up, and just a couple of quick questions to close us out here. For anyone coming to New York in the future, what's your favorite place to work? Favorite place to chill, get a drink after work.
Okay, favorite place to work. I think the Mish office here in New York. We've got a good setup down at WeWork over in Williamsburg. If anyone's passing through, we may have a spare desk, so give me a shout. Favorite place to have a drink, there's an amazing bar called Annabelle Basin up in Long Island City. If you've ever seen the panning movie shot where it, you know, scans down the Manhattan skyline, you're probably looking at it from in front of this bar, so check out if you come along.
Brilliant. Where do you get your news from? Do you read blogs, do you read books, and how do you find them?
Absolute combination of those things. So, you know, I read a lot of TechCrunch, guilty of that. They're one of our favorite clients. I still tune into stuff probably a lot more than I should. actually, surprisingly, I consume a lot of my daily news off Reddit. I find it's a good source and good way to filter the content and then make sure only the relevant and important stuff gets in front of you.
Brilliant. Right, and final question, one of my favourites. What can we do to help? Who do you want to speak to from the great Kiwi diaspora and beyond?
Yeah, cool. So, you know, I think for us at the moment, the main goal is around growth. And more specifically here in the US. So, you know, anyone who believes they might be a fit for our product or knows people who might be a fit for our product, which broadly we sort of categorise as, are you a B2C company that's targeting millennials? If that's the case, you should probably be, you know, utilizing Snapchat in some way. So, you know, if anyone listening to this has either works in a marketing agency, works for a brand, or knows people that do, you know, I'd absolutely love introductions. The other side as well, we're doing a lot of recruiting around salespeople here in New York. So if anyone's a gun on sales and has a visa here to work in the US or was a resident here in the US, would love to have a chat.
Brilliant. Thanks, Tom, so much for your time today. Really appreciate you taking a half hour out of your day. We'll make sure that anyone who can help out can get in touch with you. And otherwise, all the best. Look forward to watching Mishguru go through the roof.
Cool. Awesome. Well, thanks a lot for having me on, Dave.